encouraging me with all the singing. You guys sound beautiful, as always. I love the singing here. It's always good to be with all of you and do that together. We're going to be in 1 Kings chapter 10. I'd invite you to open your Bibles there, and we'll read from that text in just a few moments. And I know that this won't be in the announcements, but Gabriel Pinedo is in Mexico for a cousin's wedding or something like that. So he will not be with us today. We'll always miss him whenever he can't be here. Happy Mother's Day. Now that we've got a 2.5-year-old and then another baby on the way, it's always exciting, Mother's Day. I mean, for Samantha it is. It kind of has meant a little bit more to me than it used to because of Samantha. With any day like this, this is a kind of day where we always say things like, you know, we don't just appreciate mothers just on today. Like, this is a day that should remind us that we appreciate them every single day. A lot of folks in our society and in our culture would say that coming to church and worshiping God on a day like this doesn't seem to really fit, because a lot of folks think that the Bible demeans women. To be fair, the Bible kind of demeans everybody, because one of our problems is that we kind of view ourselves a little bit too highly. But with that being said, the Bible portrays women in a very positive light. Genesis 1 and 2, creation was capped off with women, with Eve. When you go through the Old Testament as a whole, you see the kind of the totality of it. There's two books in the Old Testament titled after women, Ruth and Esther. In the New Testament, the glorious bride of Christ is pictured as a bride. So there's a lot of things that we could say that the Bible says is positive about women. And I thought it would be nice this morning to look at a story of a woman that Jesus holds up as an example, not just for other women, but for all Christians. This Queen of the South, the Queen of Sheba, found in 1 Kings chapter 10. In a lot of ways, this is a conversion story. And we'll see how Jesus in just a moment holds her up as an example for all people. Let's go ahead and read 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 1 through 13. 1 Kings 10, 1 through 13. Now when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And when the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, their cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. And she said to the king, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and your wisdom. But I did not believe the reports until I came with my own eyes have seen it. And behold, the half was not told to me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report that I heard. Happy are your men, happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Moreover, the fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought from Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones. And the king made of the almug wood wood supports for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, also lyres and harps for the singers. No such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. And King Solomon gave to the Queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked beside what was given her by the bounty of King Solomon. So she turned and went back to her own land with her servants. This is a very interesting story. And maybe as we were reading this, you were starting to wonder, well, where is Sheba? Four times in this text, she's called the Queen of Sheba. If you were to look at a modern day map, you wouldn't find a location called Sheba, at least if you did find a place that was called that, it wouldn't be the same place. This is modern day Yemen. And from where the Queen of Sheba is traveling in this text, from Yemen to Jerusalem, is about a 1,400-mile trip. In the ancient world, a trip this long would take 1 to 2 years. Can you imagine the kind of traveling that she would have done? And she's also bringing with her all of these spices, perfumes, gems, and gold, which Yemen was known for. In a lot of ways, this is like the Old Testament version of the Ethiopian eunuch. In fact, a lot of people have wondered, the story of the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8, how is it that this man way to the south in Ethiopia knows anything about God that he wants to go to Jerusalem and worship? Well, it's very possible that through this story, the knowledge of God came to the south, because Ethiopia and Yemen are pretty close to each other. So some people have actually speculated that the Ethiopian eunuch knew about God because of the things that this woman does in this story, which is kind of interesting. If you look at verse 1 in our text, it says that the Queen of Sheba heard the fame of Solomon. Verses 6 and 7, when she actually meets Solomon, she's talking about how all the reports that I heard are true, and the things that I've heard didn't even tell me half of what I've seen. The thing that draws the Queen of Sheba to this area is because all these people have been talking about Solomon from thousands of miles away. In 1 Kings, there are two chapters that depict for us in great detail the kind of wealth and wisdom that Solomon had. The two chapters are chapters 4 and 10. Go over to chapter 4 really quick. And look at what would have been told in these reports. 1 Kings chapter 4. And look at verses 29 to 31. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand of the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. Now, we read those names in verse 31, and I can't even pronounce them. We read those names now, and we think to ourselves, I don't know who those guys were, but back then, those were the wise people of society. Those were the guys that knew everything. Solomon surpassed all of their wisdom, and it says basically that his wisdom was incalculable. There is no way that you could quantify his wisdom. And so people had been streaming to Jerusalem and learning about him, and these reports had come to the Queen of Sheba at some point. But go over to chapter 10, and look what it says about his wealth. This is the same chapter that this story's in. Look at 1 Kings chapter 10, and look at verses 21 to 23. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold. Can you imagine that? Like, you open up your cupboard and all of your cups are solid gold. And that's what you drink from every day. And all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. Can you imagine a house being described as the house of the forest of Lebanon? That sounds like an awesome description for a house. I want a house like that. And it continues to say, they were all pure gold. None were of silver. Silver was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon. For the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. Thus, King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. Can you imagine that you've gotten to this point of such prominence that every year these ships come in, and I've always wanted to say apes and peacocks in a sermon. Like, these ships bring apes and peacocks to this guy, so Solomon's backyard was like a zoo. Can you imagine having that kind of wealth? All of these people in all the surrounding cities are bringing all this kind of tribute to him. Now, one of the things that the New Testament does for us is it teaches us how to read the Old Testament. So you've got a story like this of this guy that's incredibly wise, this guy that's incredibly wealthy, and it's all spoken of in a very positive kind of way. Well, what does the New Testament teach us about this story? How does it give us a lens to view what's happening here? In Matthew chapter 12, there's a scene where there's some folks that want Jesus to give them a sign from heaven. Show us some kind of cool thing in the sky so that we can know that you're the Son of God, Jesus. Do something for us. And Jesus rebukes them, and he says in Matthew chapter 12, verse 42, "The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Jesus makes the claim here that I'm greater than Solomon. You might look at that and scratch your head a little bit, because he said in other places that he doesn't have a place to lay his head at night. So how can he be greater than Solomon? All of Solomon's wealth is a way to picture the riches of the blessings that Jesus has to offer. They're like a living, like a physical parable of what Jesus offers on a spiritual kind of level. By the way, you ever hear people ask the trivia question, who is the wisest person in the Bible? And we always say, Solomon. Jesus says, nope, it's me. So whenever you get that question there, always answer that with Jesus. But notice what Jesus is saying here. If he's greater than Solomon, and Jesus was living in a time where people were coming up to him and demanding signs and weren't really seeking out his wisdom, Jesus says that this woman's example is going to condemn you because you guys aren't doing the same thing. Here's the lens that we view this story with. This queen does what all of us ought to do. It's like Solomon is foreshadowing Jesus and the queen is foreshadowing Christians. And so as we walk through this story, we have to ask ourselves the question, are we doing what the queen of the south does in this story? Are we following her example? And indeed, are we following it even more, with more fervor than she did? Because there's something greater than Solomon, and that's Jesus, who we all are in covenant with. Try to imagine what happens in this story. You got this queen of Sheba, and I imagine that she's in this really nice palace. She's got people like fanning those leaves so she has like air conditioning and stuff like that. And eventually one day, a servant bolts open the door and he says, "Have you heard about Solomon, this guy in Jerusalem, in Palestine area? Have you heard about this guy?" And the queen's like, "No, I don't know about this guy." "Well, he's really, really wise and he's really, really wealthy." Can you imagine, as those kinds of reports would go to different rulers in the ancient world, how they would have received news like that? Every king, every queen, everybody that was in a position of prominence wanted to be the top dog. And so to hear a report like that would kind of strike a chord against the ego of any ruler. So this woman, as she hears what's happening here, she says, "I'm going to come up with the toughest questions, the hardest questions that I can think of, and I'm going to test him with these hard questions." I don't know what some of those questions were. Why does God allow evil and suffering? What's the meaning of life? I don't know what kinds of questions they were. But she gets together all of her camels and all of her chariots and everything like that. And for this journey that's going to take 1 to 2 years, I imagine that she's got the nicest chariot. She's got all kinds of people guarding her and everything, sort of like what the Ethiopian eunuch probably had. And for a year or two, she makes her long journey to Jerusalem. And on the way, I imagine that maybe she's got a recorder who's like writing down all of the hard questions so she doesn't forget. And then she's refining the questions because she's got months to do that. But try to imagine the day that the chariot starts to get close to Jerusalem. And she's been daydreaming about what kind of wealth this guy actually has. And as it comes in view, she sees the glory of the temple. And she starts to probably realize at this point that any wealth that I have, any prominence that I have, pales in comparison to what I'm already seeing. And as she gets up to the gates, I imagine that the people living in Israel were used to having folks from other countries come in and check out Solomon and listen to him. And so they usher her in. And I imagine that she's just, her mind is just blown with everything she's seeing. But she gets to go before Solomon. And she asks all of her hard questions. I imagine that she started with kind of the softballs, the easy ones, to kind of like test the waters a little bit. But she comes initially, it seems, with an arrogant attitude. "I want to see if this guy's really as wise as people say he is." And she asks a question, and it gets answered. And then she asks another question, and it gets answered, and another one, and it gets answered. And all of the questions get adequately answered. Imagine Solomon, he's like rubbing his chin, sitting on the throne, and he's just like the wise guy. Have you ever had an experience before where you went somewhere that was, there was a lot to take in? And as you're trying to process everything that's happening, there's like a few things that really stick out to you. As this woman is trying to process everything, she sees the house of Solomon. She sees all the colorful food at the tables. But look at verse 5. One of the things that she specifically notices and she comments on is that Solomon offered burnt offerings. Well, why is that significant, that she would comment on the burnt offerings? Because this isn't a moment where this queen is simply learning about this really wise person. She's learning about the God that's blessed this wise person. In fact, she's actually going to praise God later on when she starts speaking. So she's learning about God from all of this, and the text says that she had no more breath in her, or no more spirit. Any sense of arrogance that she once had, any sense of competitive attitude that she once had, was completely evaporated. Because she lost all of her breath that she had about this. Now, it's interesting. The text says that she lost her breath, but she has a lot to say with somebody who has no breath. So in verses 6 and 7, she says, "The reports are true. Not even half of the things that I heard. There's more than everything that I ever imagined would have happened." Have you ever had somebody really talk up a restaurant to you? They're like, "It's the greatest thing ever." And then you try it, and your expectations have been set really, really, really high because of how much that person talked about it. And you're like, it was pretty good. If he didn't talk it up so much, I probably would have thought it was better. I do that to people, so that's why I know that that's what happens. But this woman has heard all these reports, and she says, "These reports didn't even do justice to my experience. Your servants are happy. These servants that you have that are in the presence of your wisdom every day, they're living the wisdom out, and I see that these people are happy." Do you suppose that most servants in kingdoms were happy people? Do you remember Haman in the book of Esther? Do you remember how insecure he was? Do you remember all the jealousy and envy he had? Do you suppose there was kind of a competitive spirit with a lot of servants in other kingdoms? That they want to be the top dog. They want to be the one that is in the position of providence, so I'm going to kill the leader to get there. By way of contrast, these servants, they're happy and they're blessed. What's interesting is after she says all of these things, she gives 120 talents of gold to the king, which is 9,000 pounds of gold. That means that this would be worth about $170 million. Brings it all to him. And in addition to that, she like unloads all the spices that she had brought right before Solomon. And she gives all of this tribute to him. But it's not that she was just giving to Solomon. Notice in verse 13 that anything she asked, Solomon would give back to her. Doesn't that remind you a little bit of Solomon himself? Didn't God come to him in a vision one day, in a dream, and said, "Anything you ask, I'll give it to you," and God gave it? Then Solomon turns around and has this woman bring tribute to him and says to her, "Anything you want, I'll give to you." Solomon's paying forward what God's done for him. Now, what do we do with a scene like this? How is it the case that we can look at a story like this and look at it through the lens that Jesus tells us to look at it? What was so amazing about this woman? Notice, first of all, why she was astonished. Why did this woman become astonished? Here's the first reason. Because she brought her questions directly to Solomon. This is a really important thing to notice. She had heard reports about Jesus, or about Solomon, the one that foreshadows Jesus. She's heard all of these reports about this man. And she doesn't think to herself, "Well, the reports are good enough. I really think this guy's great. Send a bunch of camels and donkeys and chariots to him, and I'm not going to go, but just give all the tribute to him." You want to know why some people get astonished at Jesus and other people don't? There's some people that just rely on reports. You know what that looks like today? Can you come to church every week and hear sermons every week, which are basically reports about the greatness of God? But never actually do any research yourself. Never actually dig into the scriptures yourself and see it. This woman becomes astonished, not just based on the reports. The reports were interesting enough and they were stimulating enough, yes. But she didn't truly lose her breath until she looked at it herself. I'm afraid that sometimes with how often we come to church and how often we study the Bible, We start to think to ourselves that there's nothing that I have to do throughout the week because I'm already being fed. And maybe the reports are encouraging and stimulating and everything like that. But I'll tell you that you never become astonished until you start looking into it yourself. You might ask, though, okay, well, that takes a lot of work. Look at how much work she did. She traveled 1,400 miles. Do you think they had really nice suspension back then on those chariots? They probably had, like, no suspension, and all of the potholes and the dirt and everything like that, like, would have gotten dirty. She's traveling for 1 to 2 years, which would be very hard work. Is it possible that sometimes you have to dig deep into the scriptures for 1 to 2 years before some things finally start to click with you? Until you finally start to really be astonished, but you have to put that work first into it? She's astonished for that reason, but ultimately it's because she asked the questions directly to Solomon. You want to know one of the ways that you can tell when somebody is really trying to seek and understand God and they're on the path to becoming astonished is when they're actually asking questions. She's got her hardest questions that she's thought of. And she's not the person who just walks around to different kingdoms and says, well, I can't explain why there's evil and suffering in the world, so there's no God. I can't explain all the perplexing, nodding kind of questions in life, so there must not be a God. You ever met people like that? You know what's a good question to ask somebody that starts saying things like that? They're asking all these questions, but they're not actually consulting the scripture about it. You could ask somebody, well, what have you been reading to help you answer those questions? Or are those questions just an excuse to not serve God? Because that's oftentimes what they become. Colossians 2:3 talks about Jesus, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Do you suppose that if you had a perplexing question, that you could go to the scripture and you could see what it says about whatever it is you're wondering about, and you take it directly to the king, that you might get answers that would be satisfying? Maybe. And maybe that would help you be astonished at Jesus. But not only is she astonished because she brought her questions directly to Solomon, but because of the attitude of the servants. I think there's a lesson in this. The attitude of the servants. When I was on the path to becoming a Christian, there were certain people that I got to interact with prior to when I got baptized. And Levi, I didn't know you'd be here today, but you're actually one of them. When I was on the way to becoming a Christian, there were people that I got to meet and know, and they just had certain kinds of attitudes that were really godly. And I saw that these folks had a certain kind of demeanor and attitude that I had not seen in anybody else before. Could it be the case that because of the way that you've been trying to live the wisdom of Jesus, that it would cause other people to be astonished at the wisdom of the one who gives you the wisdom in Jesus? That's why she's astonished. But let's ask this question. What did she give? We didn't really talk about it, but in verses 11 and 12, we've got Hiram, king of Tyre, bringing a bunch of stuff to King Solomon. You've got the woman herself bringing all of this stuff to King Solomon. You've got the wealth of the nations streaming into Jerusalem. This is actually a prophecy. This depicts a prophecy that would be later on in the Bible in Isaiah. Look at Isaiah chapter 60. Verses 3 through 5. It says, "And nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. Lift up your eyes all around, and see, they all gather together, they come to you. Your sons shall come from afar, and your daughters shall be carried on the hip. Then you shall see and be radiant, your heart shall thrill and exult, because of the abundance of the sea shall be turned to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you." This is a description of the restored kingdom. And Solomon's kingdom is kind of another picture of the restored kingdom of Jesus on a physical kind of level. Notice what this is saying. That there's going to come this day where the nations will see the light of the bride of Christ. They'll see the light of the New Jerusalem. And these nations will stream to it and bring all their wealth to this place. That's what's happening with Hiram. That's what's happening with the Queen of the South in this story. I have a question about this, though. Did King Solomon need that wealth? Did he need it? Look at 1 Kings 10, verse 14. It's the next verse after the story we just read. 1 Kings 10:14 says, now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. That's a lot of gold. Now, I don't know if that was just 1 year of taxes and tribute. I don't know if that's what it was every single year. But Solomon by no means needs all of this wealth that she's giving to him. Do people ever look at God that way? Why does God need me to glorify him? Doesn't he have enough glory in heaven? Doesn't he have enough followers? Does he just have like a low ego and he needs people to lift him up a little bit? Why did she give this? Daniel, for the offering this morning, was reading from 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 teaches that when people give financially, it's actually a sign that they've first given themselves to God. When this woman is giving this tribute to Solomon, it's not because Solomon just needs more wealth. When we give praise to God, it's not just because he needs more of it, but it's a sign that we've given ourselves to him fully. Try to track what happens with this woman. She comes initially to compete with Solomon, I think, to test him with hard questions. When she gives the tribute, it's because there's no more spirit of competition anymore. She's seen how awesome this guy is, so she doesn't need to fight him anymore. When we give to God, we're giving from a heart that means there's no more competition. I don't want to dictate my life for myself. You're the one that's greater. You're the one that's more prominent. You're the one who calls the shots. And my offerings to him is just an indication that that's what I believe. But when Isaiah 60 talks about the wealth of nations streaming into Jerusalem, it talks about people as if they're the treasure. You know what all of this tribute that is being brought to Jerusalem really represents? It's a physical way to picture that God treasures anybody that gives themselves to him. Exodus 19, the Israelites on Mount Sinai. If you obey me and you give to me, you give yourselves to me, you will be my treasured possession. Do you view God that way? That when you worship God and you think about God and you've given yourself to him, that he views you as his treasure. That's what all of these vivid pictures of the wealth streaming to this city are supposed to represent in passages like Isaiah and in Revelation 21 and 22 with the new heavens and the new earth. But notice what she received. Not only did she give everything, look at what she received. A lot of folks think, okay, well, if I have to become astonished at the wisdom of Jesus and I give to him and I realize that there's no competition, he's the greater one, he's the one who calls the shots, that means that I have to miss out on a lot of things that would be really fun to do in life. A lot of people view Christianity as kind of a killjoy in that way. Everything I want to do, Jesus says I can't do. But in verse 13, the king gives to the queen anything she wants. You know, we've got passages in the Bible that we might have a knee-jerk reaction to, but here's one of them. Psalm 37, verse 4, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. We've got another passage like 1 John 5:15, and if we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know that we have the requests that we have asked of him. Here you've got the story of this woman who gets whatever she wants from the king. Does the Bible teach that for those who delight themselves in Jesus and are astonished at his wisdom and his brilliance, that they get the things that they ask for? Yeah, the Bible teaches that. But here's what it means. If you delight yourself in the Lord, will you pray to God for sinful things? No. If you delight yourself in the Lord, do you know what kinds of things that you're going to want? The things that the Lord offers. Forgiveness. No more guilt. Eternal security. A place in heaven. Brethren who are loving and sacrificing. A community of people like this. You delight yourself in God. If he becomes your treasure because he treasures you, the things that you want become the things that he wants for you. And that's what this woman is experiencing in this story. Try to imagine if this woman would have gone to these other people in these other nations that were known for their wealth and wisdom. Would she have gotten anything like this experience? She would have gone to the people of Egypt. She would have gone to the people of Babylon. She would have gone to whoever else. She would not have experienced these kinds of blessings. And by the way, we all live with this kind of thing in our lives today. There's different religions, there's different ideologies, there's different ways of looking at the world that seem wise and they seem smart. But you're only going to find the blessings in one place. Jesus would teach in the Gospels that he who seeks to save his life must lose it. And then you start to experience what true life is all about. This woman gave everything and she received everything. If you're here this morning, Jesus said that the Queen of the South will rise up in judgment for those who have something greater than Jesus. Are we being astonished at the one that's greater than Solomon? Are we working with the questions that we have to bring them directly to him so that they can be answered? Are we giving everything that we can for Jesus? And are we experiencing the reception of the blessings that Jesus has to offer? If not, the Queen of the South will rise up in judgment. If there's anything we can do for you this morning, please come forward while we stand, while we sing.